Welcome to Automates, the podcast that brings you musings from thought leaders and industry pioneers who are shaping the way we work, think, and succeed. Each episode is packed with insights, expert interviews, and practical tips that will inspire and empower you to take your business to the next level. So tune in, subscribe, and get ready to innovate with Automates.
Tim? Welcome. How are you? You well?
I'm all good, Ben. Good to be here.
Excellent. Fantastic. So I always start this with a quick intro. So Tim, why don't you start with a quick intro about who you are, what you do, and then we can dive into some really interesting conversation.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Tim Follett. I'm the CEO and the founder of StructureFlow. I used to be a practicing M&A lawyer, spent about 10 years in practice, and then I did this crazy thing about 7 years ago of quitting my job and starting StructureFlow. StructureFlow is a visual modeling platform for the professional services industry. And what that basically means is we help lawyers and accountants and finance professionals create visualizations of complex structures and transactions and business processes.
Okay.
And yeah, we've been going for a while now, and we've got a really solid customer base, got some really happy customers all over the world, and team of about going on 50 people. So wow. We're doing well.
Awesome. I think it's really interesting, sort of the area that you're in. So that visualization. So I spent a bunch of meetings this week talking to our leadership team, and then I spent a bit of time with a couple of people yesterday talking about the absolute need in my life to reduce complexity. There's too many complex things in my brain. I can't process them. So I guess the genesis for StructureFlow was to start to think about, okay, well, how can we present this information in a much clearer, simpler way for laymen like me, people who don't read contracts particularly well or whatever?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know if you've had this, Ben, where you're trying to get your head around something and you grab a piece of paper and you start drawing boxes. And
yeah. That's my
exactly,
life.
Exactly, connecting the shapes and things like that. And it's a very natural thing for people to do. And if you think back to when we're kids and you think about our kids now, learning tends to be very visual when we're young. And yet when we grow up and we move into the professional world, things can get less visual. And I always felt like visualization was a really important tool in the toolkit as a lawyer. I saw the power that it had to enable people to get your head around something, but also to explain it to other people. That could be clients or it could be colleagues. And there was just this amazing ability to cut through that complexity in the world that we're in. And yet it was being kind of underutilized because it was just so blimming hard to create the visuals that you wanted.
I used to have to, as a business analyst back in the day within my IT days, I remember just sort of sitting there with Visio and just hating the world because you can never achieve what's in your mind's eye. But actually, I guess now Autologic's process platform, we spend our lives sort of mapping out things and thinking about, and we would never, we couldn't do without literally the hundreds of bits of paper that I've got scattered around the desk that nobody can see, whiteboards and things like that. So it's a big part of, as you say, how people think. And I think so talk me through a specific use case. Is it component parts? Is it entity structures or deal structures? Again, pretend I'm a moron. It shouldn't be too hard to pretend, but pretend I'm a moron.
Yeah. So, I mean, visual content has been part of what professionals have been working with for some time.
Yeah.
And there's some types of work where it's absolutely fundamental. You cannot do the work without it.
Yeah.
So an example of that might be a complex corporate restructuring, where you've got a very complex set of entity relationships, corporate group, maybe 500, 1,000 different entities in it, a lot of a lot of history, external and intragroup debt and security all over the place. And you're trying to get your head around, okay, what am I working with here? What do we need to fix? Well, in order to fix it, I need to understand what there is. And so I need to map that, and that mapping is done visually. And so, you know, that has been going on for a long time. People have been using PowerPoint to create these maps and then steps plans as to, okay, we're going to do this, then we're going to do this, then we're going to do this. Quite a lot of complex tax structuring as well is very similar. Basically just can't do that work without working visually. It's inherent. You also then have other areas, other use cases where it may not be so fundamental, but it is a very, very key ingredient in improving the client experience. Because people today don't want to read huge amounts of complicated text. We live in a very visual world. Smartphones and the way that we interface with information now is all digital. It's dynamic. It's slick. We expect to have that in our work lives as well. And so the clients of today in 2025 do not want to be sent by their law firms 20-page memos. They want to be sent information in a way that they can look at it and eyeball it and just very quickly understand what's going on. And so there are a whole wide range of use cases where actually presenting the work product in a more visual way and explaining things in a more visual way is very, very impactful, very important to an improved client experience. And at the end of the day, professional services, it's all about the delivery of those services to the clients.
Makes 100% sense. And I think it's sort of, as I said, I spend my life talking to people about reducing complexity, A, partly because my brain can't cope, but also B, there's just so much information and so much that you have to digest and starting to look at that.
There is an interesting factoid that we've come across, we've been using a bit, which talks to that kind of ever-increasing kind of volume of information. Because I don't know if you feel this, right? But it is kind of, there's just so much now that comes at you. You know, you're just on a regular day, right? Just the amount of information that you're processing. And like, I don't know if you find this, even like WhatsApp, like the amount of messages is just crazy.
But it's not so, I often tell this story, and my wife never listens to this or watches this, so she won't mind. But I will invariably receive the same message from my wife, first through WhatsApp, then through iMessage, then an email, if I haven't responded in a particular order. So it's not necessarily the volume of content that is different. It's the volume of repeated content in different platforms where you're thinking about different things. And I completely get you. It's like there is so much. There is so much. There is too much. But I think it's so easy to create. It's easy to create. I can send a message and sort of forget about it because I've done it. It's off my plate to do. But actually, the recipient of that message has now got an action to either read it, process it, act on it, do something else. And you sort of create this cascading flood of more knowledge, more information than you could ever dream of.
Exactly. And it can be quite oppressive and
100%.
Stress inducing. And you know, you think about the amount of interactions that someone today has over a 24-hour period, whether it's email, WhatsApp, iMessage, anything else, versus 10 or 20 years ago, right? And the pay in all of those interactions are human beings connecting for some reason to do something, right? And so, you know, we are, I think, accelerating. Like we probably, you know, there probably is, you know, some volume of it which is kind of superfluous and could just be cut. There is probably, though, generally a tendency towards we are just doing more stuff faster than we've ever been able to do before. And I just going back to the factoid piece, there was a guy called Eric Schmidt. He was the CEO of Google in 2010. And he had a line, and he said this in 2010, that between the dawn of civilization to around 2003, 5 exabytes of information were created in total by humanity. And then in 2010, fast forward to 2010, that same volume of information is being created by humanity every 2 days.
Wow.
And that is kind of crazy. And an exabyte is some huge volume of information. It's something like 11 million 4K films, something like that. It's huge, right? But, and I hope I've got this factoid right. And if I haven't, I do apologize to the listeners, but you know, you get the gist, right? It is just this crazy increase in the amount of information that we're having to handle and to digest and understand. And it does apply in the professional services world.
100%.
Like, of course it does. And, you know, technology is both, you know, the culprit and the savior, potentially.
Yeah, 100%.
Because as you just said, right, all those messages that you're getting, they're being recorded in different places. It's the same message, but it's creating more information that you need to work your way through. And so I do think it's incumbent on technology providers like us to work out, well, how can we cut through all of that complexity? How can we make stuff simpler for the human beings that are having to deal with it?
Yeah. And I think there's a big opportunity there. It's sort of a plug for what we do, but it's not meant to. This isn't what this is about. But it's there is an argument to say that a bunch of what we receive that we need to action, we shouldn't be receiving anyway, because it's either rules-based or it's a piece of knowledge that is self-findable or whatever it might be. So there's that automation aspect of, okay, well, somebody needs to do something. That's fine. I'm going to ask Tim because I know Tim knows the answer. But actually, can we create a system that provides the answer at the right time because they're at the right stage of a process that mapping to the, you know, that kind of whole, that proactive view of technology in terms of delivering what somebody might need at the point of that process being mapped. And I think that's a big part of it.
I just before we move, I'd say, you know, your kit, it clearly has a very strong linkage into that, because you can take the human being out of the loop, you know, there'll be arguments about, oh, do you want to, and you know, are you taking things away from humans and giving them to machines and things? But if you can take some monotonous, boring tasks that used to be done by a human being away from them, so that they no longer have to do that and can do other more interesting things, then you know, clearly that has massive utility.
100%, 100%, and I think that's a big driver. So I was gonna ask you a question. So I think I already know the answer based on what we've just been talking about. But what was the straw that broke the camel's back for you as a 10-year in M&A lawyer? What was the moment which was, actually, there's got to be a better way of doing this. I'm gonna do it. So what was the moment? What was the thing?
Yeah, there was a moment of like, I don't know, there was a shower moment. I'd been for a run and got back and was in the shower, and there was a kind of like, I could do something about this, and I'm going to give it a go. There was a moment. I remember it really well. It's a sunny day and I'd been for a run up in North London. Run up to Highgate and back, and got into the shower, and everything had been kind of whizzing around in my mind. I kind of realized at that point that I felt a compulsion, a need to give this a go. And that was at the end of a long period of exploring the problem space. I got interested in legal technology first. I just got interested in it and the general space, and there are a few other kind of problem areas that I was interested in solving for, which people have gone on to do wonderful things with. And this problem area around kind of visualization, and it felt very personal, and it felt like I had an emotional attachment to it because I have always been very visual, going back to school and university. And, you know, I had a teacher at school, a history teacher at school, that used to teach things like, you know, the Battle of Bosworth and the Tudors and things like that, and would do it with timelines and would get you to draw your own cartoon like timelines. You know, I can remember kind of things like, you know, how you learn about the water cycle and the structure of molecules and things like that. And I've just always been very visual. And when I got to Slaughter and May, I started using that skill set, and I saw that it had this kind of this USP to it, that it had this quality of enabling me to understand something really, really well. And I could read through a whole load of contracts and emails and corporate registers, and I could draw a structure chart, and I could get my head around what was going on in this factual universe that I was looking at.
Yeah.
And because I was so confident about what was going on as a result of that, I could walk into a partner's room and the partner could say something to me or ask me a question and I could respond. And if he challenged me or he got it wrong, I could say, I'm sorry, but you're actually wrong. And I know for a fact that, you know, the position is this or that. And so visualization kind of had this ability to give me an underlying confidence in what I was doing. It also enabled me to explain it. Stuff to people. I can remember going into a partner's room at Slaughter's and sitting there, and he was asking me to sort of report back on something I'd been looking at. And I said, well, look, do me a favor. Can I show you a picture? Oh, no, you know, just talk it through to me, Tim, please. Just talk it through. Seriously, Jonathan, I'm going to give you something. Just look at this. Let's talk it through together. Okay. All right. Okay. You know, you could just very quickly see, very, very quickly see that process of putting something visual in front of two people and using that as a reference point for a conversation was a very powerful thing to do. It really facilitated a mutually constructive and well-aligned conversation in a way that is just very, very hard to achieve if you're just speaking.
Speaking and referring to reams and reams and reams of paper, contracts, emails that you need to reference, you need to, but you're right, it's sort of that whole sort of view of the world, it just brings that sort of clarity, or the clarity or the points to which you can sort of drive that clarity through. It's really interesting. These are aha moments that you sit there and go, actually, there is something I can do here. But actually, what's really interesting, the confidence that you gain from doing it without a product, so the bare bones of it, the time and the effort that you took to craft and create these things, you said it gave you confidence in like the concept and everything and sort of to evolve it and push through. But as a lawyer, did it give you that kind of, was it like a little superpower, which confidence aside, it's that actually, I know this is right. And then other associates, other lawyers looking at, I want one of those. Can I have one of those? You know, did that then solidify further the idea that actually, if there was something that could do this, I could help more than my team. I could help hundreds of lawyers.
Absolutely. That's how it played out. I remember seeing people in my group starting to use visuals more. As a sort of mid-level associate, you know, you start working with trainees and juniors and you start seeing them using it, the work that you're doing together. I also started to see that there were other people in the firm that were trying to harness this superpower as well. And I think it is a kind of superpower, and I've seen it across our customer and user base. You know, there are people out there that have been doing this for a long time, way, way before me. And they've been trying to, I would say, harness this superpower.
Yeah.
And what we're trying to do is make that superpower accessible to everyone, you know? So you don't have to be a PowerPoint wizard or, you know, spend 10 hours on a weekend trying to get your head around Visio or something else to be able to start using this. Actually, it should be possible to use visualization across you know, a wide range of different people within the industry.
And different use cases. I mean, I guess the way that you, as you crafted the idea around your day-to-day and then sort of added product capability and sort of evolved that, it must be one of those things whereby your customers are driving your ideas further because, you know, you've got a good idea, you've got a good product team around you. You think about how you might drive particular use cases that resonate with people that were like you 3-4 years ago, but actually you put it in the hands of customers. And it was always the case. It's the case with us with Autologics. When I was at HiQ, you'd sell it for one thing, but ultimately what they were doing with it 3, 4, 6, 9, 12 months later, it was like, oh, I've not thought of that. That's interesting. Is that, but that drives future product enhancements because you can sit there and go, actually, well, it's not quite right for that. But if we added these three things and put them into the roadmap and sort of evolve, you're making that idea, you can still achieve it today, but actually you're making the product more accessible even further for those new ideas and those new things. So Tim, I mean, one of the things that sort of other lawyers that are thinking about becoming legal tech sort of startup founders and just people in general, I mean, it's the having the confidence in your idea to go off and not assume, but know that you can have a good chance of making a difference. We know that there are, for every 100 businesses that are created, there's a certain percentage that fail and there's certain people who go through. It'd be really interesting to dig into sort of the early years of StructureFlow, which are often the hardest years because you're pre-revenue, you know what you want to achieve, but you've got to build it. You've got to find a team. You've got to find people you can trust. What does that look like? What was the first couple of years like for you taking something that was so solid in your mind as a product and as a concept? How did you evolve that? Did you find a CTO? What are the things that you, the steps that you sort of went through?
I never felt like I really had a choice around whether I was going to do this or not. I felt a compulsion to do it,
yeah,
which in some ways made it easier because I just knew that I had to do this. It's something for me, my experience, it starts as a hobby. You are doing your day job. You're exploring something else. You start to find yourself working on it evenings, weekends, and it kind of snowballs. You start to find that you're becoming quite obsessive about it. And it starts to kind of take over your mind.
Yeah.
So I was doing my day job and kind of progressing the early work for what is now StructureFlow. And it came to a point in 2017 where I just had my second little boy and I'd spent 2 weeks of paternity leave working on StructureFlow. And my wife said, you've got to make a choice now. Do you, you know, are you going to jump or not jump?
Yeah.
And for me, there was just no, there was, I only could jump.
Yeah.
So for anyone listening to this, I'm not going to say that my experience is going to dictate yours, but I would say you've got, in my opinion, you've got to have that strong sense of compulsion to do something like this. And the reason that's important is that it's going to be tough. And I remember people telling me when I started out, it's going to be tough. And I just went, I know it's going to be tough. And I did, but I didn't know how it was going to be tough then.
Yeah.
And I've seen that play out. And, you know, the thing that you need to get you through the tough times is conviction. You know, people talk about stamina and resilience and all the rest of it. And yeah, you need that. You do need that. You need, and I didn't have a lot of thick skin when I started this. You know, as a lawyer, yeah, you work hard, but do you have thick skin? Do you have stamina and resilience? Well, you probably have a bit of it, but you know, the thing that really I think is important is conviction. You've just got to have a view of, I know what I'm doing is right. I know that there is an opportunity for this thing in the market. And I know that if I work hard at this, there is a chance that I can make a success of it. And if you have that conviction, that is what powers you through.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's really powerful, because I think you look at it, and I mean, I've talked to a bunch of people probably in the last 6 months who different stages of their career. Some are lawyers, some are consultants, some are people, and they go, "What do you think?" I mean, and they automatically, tech's quite easy now. Gen AI can build me a product. I can do this. I can do that. I could build these things. And it's like, okay, that's great, but that's like 10%. You know, you've got to have, there's so many other things that sort of come around that, that you've got a good idea, but what's the market? You know, there's so many different aspects. But I think if you're all in, you know, if you are, you have that conviction in your idea and the potential benefits that it brings to people. I mean, I often think about the, there's a big gap in legal tech being sort of really, it's functional. It does a whole bunch of stuff, and it's saving documents and creating documents and everything else. But I think that doesn't reduce complexity. I think if you can make somebody feel like that they don't get a brain ache when they have to do something, you're making a little bit of a difference. And it isn't, it's tech, and you're making sort of the, you talk about client experience and client expectations, but actually that isn't just what you're doing, in my opinion. You're making it simpler to do something. You're distilling down something which is inherently complex into something that's more easy. So you're creating less stress for people, whether it be the people that have to do the work or the people that have to consume it. And so I think that that whole idea around sort of not the lifestyle, but the idea that everyone has to work hard, everyone's working hard so much, everyone's running at everything. I'd love my life to be a bit quieter and a bit simpler. And I think they're the things that sort of, you're making a difference to somebody's personal life. Because I can say this, again, I said it earlier, my wife doesn't listen to this. If I've had a really crappy day and I've done 12 hours and it's been hell, I am not nice to be around. I'm not. And if you can shave that, 12 hours to be a shorter period of time because your tool does something X, Y, Z, or if you're on the recipient of it and actually you've been able to consume something, it makes sense and you're happier. I think that's what tech is, sort of productivity and efficiency. But if you can make the end user, the human at the end of the screen or the end of the keyboard, a little bit happier, I think that's a really powerful thing. I don't think it doesn't sell software, because ultimately people don't, they do care, but they don't care. Individuals care, but corporates sometimes care. That sounds terrible, but you know what I mean. But it's the, I think that's a, it's a big sort of takeaway at the moment, where I'm seeing products that add that little bit of extra smile at the end of somebody's day.
It doesn't sell software, but it's actually a really important part of the value proposition and the value that gets delivered. I mean, why do we do what we do, Ben? Why do you do what you do?
I don't know. Why do I do what I do? I ultimately do it for my family. That's the end. That's the end goal. I want to make sure that my family are looked after and everything else. But in the world, I want to make sure that I've got a happy team, happy customers, and people that come on board with us, partner with us. I don't like talking about customers and clients and everything else. I talk about partners, and not partners in, but in terms of, okay, we want to come in and we want to help you. It isn't just, here's a bit of kit and we'll go off and sell it to somebody else. We like to embed ourselves in people's processes and understand what they do for a living and how they work and what good looks like and what can we make a little bit better. And I think that's the big thing for me. It's like, can we create a few smiles? Honestly, it's sort of, and that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the same for me. Can we create a few smiles? Can we give some people some enjoyment?
Yeah.
Can we make a difference to people's lives for the better? You know, recognizing that we're not kind of fighting world hunger or something like that we operate particular domain with a particular world of people around us. But there is something around, for me, the reason I'm doing this is because I thought there was a way to make people like me have a better experience of being a lawyer. I thought that there was something that was kind of missing, and there was a gap to be filled, and that I wanted to fill it, and that I wouldn't feel satisfied unless I'd filled it. So there is inevitably a degree of self-fulfillment, right? So I guess there's a, you know, there is a selfishness, a self-interest, I guess, around it, because, you know, there is an opportunity to, you know, to be known as the person that did that thing or built that company or, you know, gave that person that bit of enjoyment. I think just being honest, there is a bit of that. But the reason I do what I do on a day-to-day basis is because I want our product to improve, and I want it to deliver value to people, and I want it to improve their experiences.
No, I mean, and that it sort of, it brings up, whilst you were talking about 10 minutes ago, I wrote down culture, because I mean, I think if you start off with an idea of a business to fundamentally improve the way people think about things and do things and everything else, I think how, and you said you've Structurefly has been around for 7 years. You've raised some money with the guys at FinTop and others. You've done really, really well. How do you keep that core of a culture or of an understanding of the reason why I started this on day one, or really started it 9 months before? How do you keep that thread of culture, value prop? What does that do as a business that grows? I mean, if you said earlier that you are 45 to 50 people, you sort of, every time you recruit somebody, I often feel every time you recruit somebody, your culture gets diluted a little bit. But it also, in my mind, it also gets, there's an opportunity to sort of, it evolves because you're bringing in new ideas and new approaches and new things that sort of you might not value, but others do. How do you keep that consistent view of what you wanted to build on day one to today and for 5 years down and 10 years down? What does that look like?
Yeah, it's because you're building not just a product, you're building a company, and the company bit is the really important bit, because product doesn't exist without the company, and the core building blocks of the company are the people. Tech is, you know, you can control technology and it's kind of deterministic and all the rest of it, but actually in order to be successful in what we're doing, you actually have to use these very complex, highly whimsical machines or units of production that are called human beings.
Exactly.
How do you get 45, 50 people who had never met each other before to come together and work together on a daily basis and align around objectives and what needs to be done and how they're going to do it? It's fascinating. And I'm learning. I'm still learning because I've never done this before. Yeah. And off the back of the Series A, we've basically doubled. And there's been a lot of change. Had a lot of people join the business. A lot of that change has been constructive. Some of it hasn't been so constructive. You know, we've had some challenges. And I think that's human. That's to be expected, that, you know, you will have some challenges. And we've had some people leave. And, you know, that's the way it is. We've had some fantastic people join. And we've had some good people leave. And, you know, you just got to, in terms of culture, in terms of how you keep it tight, and, you know, it's a lot of it is coming, it's coming from the core. It's coming from me, but the people that I've built out around me and the shared values that we have. And, you know, it's a bit of a club. You know, you're building a company, it's a bit of a club. You know, who do you want to join the club? Are these the right people to join the club? And it does become a little bit self-fulfilling as well.
That makes a lot of sense. Sort of, anyone that's been in an interview with me or talked to me about a job over the last however many years, I often try and I refer to this puzzle analogy, which is you build a team around the concept of a puzzle. You know what the picture broadly needs to look like, But actually, all of these different pieces, they're similar, i.e. they're humans, but they're not the same. They've got different skills. They've got different edges. They've got different component parts. They've got different colors. They're part of different patterns, you know. And you sort of, the club analogy is a really good one, because you sort of, your core team need to be on board with the vision, the mission. They need to contribute to the vision and the mission and the idea of how they're going to evolve and contribute to those things. But I think it's that building a team, particularly, well, when did you do your Series A? Was it 18 months, a year ago?
April last year, so about 12 months.
So you've doubled in size in less than 12 months, which
basically
is, that's growing pains, you know, and that's the thing. That's one of those things that you sort of, you start to look at, and sort of these are markers of success, you know, and you're going to have things that, you sort of alluded to, there are going to be things that you're not happy with how they happened. You're not happy that they actually happened, but you learn from it. You know, you won't do it. It's not you won't do it again, but the business needs to learn from these moments to then make sure that the product, the customer, the team, the culture, whatever it might be, sort of comes back to what's important, which is going forward.
I don't know if you've experienced this, but I think I found that the hard stuff is the soft stuff. As in, when I was a lawyer, some of the things that we're now having to wrestle with around culture and the kind of group psychology, if you like, of team and how we get people to work together really well, I would have thought of back then as sort of, it's kind of like soft stuff. Like the really hard stuff is being a lawyer, isn't it? And, you know, drafting the documents, getting the deal done by that ridiculous timeline, deadline that the client set. And, you know, that's the hard stuff. And, you know, now I kind of look on it and I am fascinated by, and I want to immerse myself more in it, human psychology. And what drives people, and how do people get other people to do what they want them to do? Now, all of that is really, it's really fascinating stuff. And I think when you're a founder of a business, when you're working in an early stage business, when you're growing a team, you're building out the company, this stuff is really important, because it is all about human beings. It's about bringing people together who don't know each other. You know, and yet you're trying to get them to come together, and you're trying to get them to connect and to fire up and to do amazing things together. And that's really, really hard.
I think just to interrupt, I think that's even harder today than it was by COVID, remote working, hybrid working, whatever you want to call today's norm, because it's different things for different organizations. We're a fully remote organization, and that has its pros and cons. You know, it is hard to think about, okay, well, we've got a project, we need to get A, B, and C together to make sure they're working on it. But, you know, back in the day, you'd chuck them in a meeting room and go and solve this, go on. And it's like, no, actually, well, so it's, that's the dynamic. It's sort of that sort of remote, I don't know if you guys are quite remote or hybrid or how it sort of works, but you sort of, I look at it and go, well, the team, I try and encourage as many touch points as possible, like things like this, little conversations, whatever it might be, because people can get lost in a day and not really speak to anyone if you're not really careful. You know what I mean? Because everyone's busy, everyone's got stuff to do, so they just get on with it. But actually, I almost try and encourage people to go, right, I need to speak to Bob, 5 minutes with Bob. And it's almost like a break, but it isn't a break, because you're learning a bit about what Bob's doing, and you might contribute and make Bob's job a little bit easier because you can solve it. I think that's really hard, particularly if you've doubled in the last year, the idea of hybrid remote working just amplifies the challenge of maintaining culture, getting people to learn how to work together, different dynamics. It must be really, that must be the hardest bit, I would guess.
What are you guys? Are you distributed or?
We're fully remote, fully remote. So we get together once every 6 to 8 weeks, basically, which works for us now at our size. I mean, we're about the same size as you were before you did your Series A. So we're about 25, 30 people.
Okay.
But, you know, it's tricky. It is tricky. Very conscious of time. I've got one more question for you. It is a quick one. Just want to say congratulations on being on the other side of the lawyer fence. So I noticed that you guys announced your acquisition of Blue Jay, I think it was last week or the week before, which must be really exciting, but really interesting though. So my question beyond the congratulations is, being on the other side of that kind of transaction and knowing what you know, how hard was it to like let the lawyers do the lawyering part, or were you fully involved in the whole process because that's the kind of world that you lived in?
Yeah, so a couple of things. Number one, we had a great part of the Jay.
Yeah.
We are still partnering with us to make this transaction a success. And yeah. We acquired the Diagram part.
Ah, okay, cool.
Products. You know, they are a much bigger business. They're quartered over in Canada. Benjamin Allery, the CEO, has been great to work with. You know, it's just made strategic sense for them and for us that we partner in this way, and we take over the kind of diagramming element of what they were doing so they can focus on their core tax products. And the fact that they were such a great partner through this has just made it a lot easier than it could otherwise have been. And I also have a fantastic COO called Jerry McHugh. And Jerry just takes a lot of the stuff that is painful. And so in that post I did on LinkedIn where I was saying, you know, it was me, you know, being on the other side, it's really Jerry that was on the other side. And I was kind of looking in because Jerry basically dealt with it. I did have a little bit of interaction, in particular at the start, around the transaction structure. And we did use Structure Flow to map it out.
Of course.
And it did help. I would say that, wouldn't I? But I really do believe it did help. And we had some great lawyers at Osler who were working on the transaction. So it was nice to be on the client side. Nice experience. And yeah, who knows? We might do something else at some point in the future.
No, I mean it's really interesting, isn't it? Sort of you go through these processes and sort of I was chatting to a founder at Legal Geek like last October, and they were going, basically I've set this up so I can exit. And it's like, okay, well, and so I've heard quite a lot of people say like they're set up and they're on a journey and they just want to exit and they want to go on to the next thing, and it's like serial entrepreneurial kind of thing. And that's it's interesting because you see what you're going through, which is you are bootstrapped, you get good product, you get good customer traction, you do a Series A, a couple of years you do Series B, or if you're an AI company, you do it after 3 months or whatever it might be. And then you sort of see that. And then that whole dynamic of acquisitions oftentimes doesn't come across a founder's desk unless you're the target. You know what I mean? Very rarely do you get that opportunity to sort of, as you say, partner and sort of and look at something in that sense. So it's quite interesting. When you announced it, like I was surprised, not that it was you guys and it was Blue Jay, but it was my brain was like, that's interesting because it is slightly different. It isn't the norm, if that makes sense. And it was good. But I think that again just references what you're keen to push on and progress and make a difference. And you're looking at ways of doing that and accelerating those processes. And it makes 100% sense.
Yeah. I mean, we're also just the hard work really started when we closed the deal, because, you know, then we've got to take a load of organizations that have been using Blue Jay diagramming, and we've got to convince them that Structure Flow is, you know, a great product for them. We've got to transform them into long-term Structure Flow customers. And,
yep.
You know, there's a lot of work that then needs to be done. We've got technical migration, we've got send in our customer success folks. We've got to schmooze. We've got to win people over. We've got to show the product is superior and that we're going in really exciting direction. All of this stuff. So there is, and but of course, you know, did I get a kick out of putting that message into the market that we did that deal? Damn straight.
Yeah. 100%, and it's like they're the little things that you sort of take a step back and you go, right, yes, another tick in the box that I'm doing stuff. Tim,
exactly.
Honestly, you could sit here and chat for hours. I know we chat at all sorts of different events and everything else, but I think you're one of these people that you're just good. You're good people. You've got great background, great understanding. You've built great product, great team. So that's great. When am I going to see you next? Am I going to see you at Legal Week?
You are.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'll be in New York.
Fine. Yeah. So we'll catch up over a quick beer at Legal Week. And yeah, we can see how we get on.
That would be great, Ben. No, thanks very much for having me on the show. I've been following the show and you've had some great other people on this. So I feel honoured to be invited and I've really enjoyed the conversation, so thank you.
No, you're a legend, mate. Take it easy and I'll catch you very soon. Thank you.
Cool, man.